Hello, you're listening to On The Point, the news collective show formerly known as Democracy Watch, bringing you alternative and undercovered current affairs coverage from Vancouver and the Lower Mainland, right here on CITR 101.9 FM. I'm Akshay Kulkarni.
I'm Maddie Delplate.
And I'm Caitlin Fung. It's Saturday, March 6th, and we're broadcasting remotely nowadays, but we're based on UBC's Vancouver campus on the ancestral, traditional, and unceded territories of the Hunkaminam-speaking Musqueam people.
Today we're talking to three members of the newly formed Coalition of African, Caribbean, and Black Nurses in British Columbia, CACBN, about anti-Black racism in the healthcare system and changing that for the better.
We'll also have a quick discussion about, who else, the Vancouver Police Department, plus new legislation around rent evictions. But first, Caitlin, your interview with the members of the CACBN. Tell us about who you spoke to.
So I spoke to three members of the CACBN, so that's the Coalition of African, Caribbean, and Black Nurses in BC. It was formed last year in 2020 after a student at the UBC School of Nursing organized a Black History Month celebration. That event was the first time the school had ever celebrated Black History Month, and it was also the first time Black nurses across their networks were able to connect. Through their shared experiences, they decided to form a coalition to address the systemic racism and anti-Blackness that they were witnessing and experiencing in healthcare. So I spoke with Netanya, Kira, and Jifa about anti-Black racism in nursing and healthcare and why their work as a coalition is a necessary response to it.
Sounds great. Let's take a listen.
My name is Kira Filbert. I identify as a queer, biracial, cis woman settler living on the unceded traditional territories of the Coast Salish, specifically the Squamish, Solo, Tsleil-Waututh, and Musqueam Nations.
My name is Netanya. I guess in terms of a little bit of my bio, I kind of interpret it a little bit differently, but my background is in mental health nursing, and I grew up in Ottawa and moved to Vancouver about a year and a half ago to start grad studies.
My name is Jifa Dordunu. I am also living here on the Lekwungen territory in Victoria, what is currently Victoria. My nursing background is in cardiology, and in terms of my personal social background, I was born in what is the present-day Ghana, and pretty much I spent time in four different countries.
All of you have such amazing, different, unique backgrounds that you're bringing to your work, and the work that we're here to talk about today is your coalition that you've started. So I'm wondering if you can tell me a little bit more about what actually is the Coalition of African, Caribbean, and Black Nurses in British Columbia.
So my name is Jifa, and I am the interim president for the organization. So the Coalition of African, Caribbean, and Black Nurses in BC was founded last year, and with the sole goal of confronting systemic racism and discrimination in nursing and healthcare broadly. The group is composed, currently the leadership group anyway, is composed of five of us, three here, and then Angela and Ishmalia are the other leaders. Our real mandate really is to explore the ways that nursing has been a bit complicit in supporting systematic racism in the healthcare setting, which is impacting the nurses and the patient as well. So our first mandate is to hear from nurses in BC about basically who they are and how they're finding the workplace. Right now we're doing a survey, and by far the number one concerns of the people that have responded to the survey has been just the way they're treated, not only by the system, but also by patients that they're taking care of. And then extending that sort of mandate is to also reach out to our individual communities, because they are also victims of racism when they're accessing health care. So we want to not only advocate for ourselves as nurses, but for the public, general public that we are responsible for supporting.
For me, I started off my career in Ottawa, where there were a few more people who looked like me. And when I came to British Columbia, the way in which anti-Black racism manifests itself was very different. And I realized that I felt way more isolated, and I knew I wasn't alone. I mean, as Zifa was saying, this I mean, racism is a problem everywhere in Canada. It's not just something specific to BC, but I think what makes BC a little bit more unique is the fact that there are few of us and we don't know where everyone is, and people tend to kind of suffer in silos, at least from my personal experience. So I feel like there is a need for the coalition to sort of put a voice to those who may not necessarily have an avenue to speak up for themselves.
I'll just add some like historical context that I think is relevant about what Jifa was saying around like nurses and nursing being complicit in white supremacy. So the first thing it's important to note is that Canada did not allow Black nurses to practice until the late 1940s. And many of them had to go to the United States or to England to get trained. And then they came back and they actually had to integrate Canadian hospitals because they were white hospitals. So UBC School of Nursing, for example, was founded in 1919. So for a good 30 years, Black students were not admitted to that program. And Nat and I are both students now at the School of Nursing. So we wouldn't have had the same opportunity when the school was founded. And that's something that we don't talk about in nursing. That's something that was new information that I just learned recently. But when you understand that nursing and Florence Nightingale and the idea of the nurse is all founded with the idea around like Victorian notions of femininity and womanhood, white middle class ideals of what it means to be a woman, and understanding that Victorian times also happened when slavery was a very real and active institution. So how am I as a perceived Black person ever supposed to match that ideal, right? I was told that I wasn't authentic. I've been told that I have an attitude problem and all these other things around my nursing practice that I have to ask, is it really about my practice? Is it really about me? Or is it that I'll just never be a white nurse? We see that in the nursing literature. There's no interrogation around who the nurse is. We talk a lot about racism, but the view of the racism is always that the nurse could be racist towards a client, but not what is it like for me? This is a situation that happened to me. I'm a home care nurse, so I go to people's homes, and I went to someone's home and his entire decor was Confederate flags, right? None of my white colleagues thought it would maybe be inappropriate to send me there, right, by myself to do this gentleman's care. We have risk screeners where we're supposed to write when there's a potential risk. It wasn't flagged in the risk screener. There was literally no thought. And I have great colleagues, and I wouldn't think that they were being racist, but if you're not being racist and you're not being anti-racist, you are being racist. So there's not a lot of reflection necessarily in the discipline within our system, really asking those kinds of questions. So that's what we're trying to start to do. We're trying to ask these questions because ultimately it's not just going to benefit us, it's going to benefit everyone.
Kara, that's a very, very heart-grabbing example of just how life here in BC is compared to maybe other places. You know, this notion of institutions not owning their history. If we can't recognize how, say, for example, UBC or any other institution here in BC has systematically excluded people, right? If we can't look at that and then reflect on, wait a minute, are we still doing the same thing now? Then we are being complicit. And because we're not asking the questions, nobody else in that institution tend to look outside of the box, right? There's no reason why Kara or anybody in nursing should be sent in that unsafe environment. So, you know, we're asking the questions to awake people's minds to the fact that, look, I don't step out of my house without the risk of harm, whether it's intentional or unintentional. And so I want people to start looking around and seeing how their actions are harmful. I also want to say that, you know, there's a complexity within what people call as Black, right? So we also want to raise that complexity, right? Not, you know, I think of the nurses that I grew up with. I never grew up seeing Florence as being the nurse. I grew up in a village, and the nurses that I saw looked like me, acted like me, spoke like me. And when I went into nursing, it was their ideals that propelled me forward. It wasn't until I was here and out in a public that I was like, whoa, I actually may not fit that type or that image of what a nurse is, and trying to navigate that complexity.
Thank you for sharing that. Yeah, and it's making me think of how complex not only the experiences of all of you as nurses is and needs to be recognized for, but also how complex and layered the harms can be that you experience in these settings. And I wonder if you could speak to, like, from the institutional side, what are the actual supports and things that they need to be doing in order to reduce those harms or to eliminate those harms and to actually support, like, Black staff and Black nurses in healthcare settings?
It's Kira. I'll try to touch on this. I think it's a great question. I think it's complicated. In BC, we have different health regions. So we might, as a Black nurse, you might work for a different health region, which might have different supports. You may or may not be involved with the union, which comes with different supports. But the thing I will say is my own organization has been trying to address racism kind of since, I think, George Floyd's death really was a jumping off point for lots of people. I don't know. A word was coming to me in French, and it's not the right word, but, like an événement déclencheur, like it was the start, a spark
that really, spark for the fire. Yeah.
The spark for the fire. Not that there wasn't anti-racist movements happening before, but definitely I think, I was seeing a lot more material coming from my own organization around those things. But what was really interesting is the racism that they're trying to address is a very globalized racism. They're just saying, don't be racist. But there isn't really a nuance around, what does it mean to do violence against Indigenous people? What does it mean to do violence against Black people? What does it mean to do violence against Asian people? You know, and then even more specific within those things, because the way that, of course, like white supremacy has worked, it's not that they'd use different strategies based on who you were. Another small thing, for example, is that they had these internal public forums, and I went to one, and it was supposed to be around violence directed towards the practitioner as a racialized practitioner. We're all racialized, but as a non-white practitioner. And they had one GP, they had one board member, and then they had one person who worked at operations at a director level, but no nurses. You would think for a giant organization that represents like all of Vancouver, you would have at least one nurse on the panel. And that was no RTs, no OTs, nothing. There was a GP who worked outside of the hospital system, and then people at much higher levels who, of course, they were affected by racism, but they don't know what the experience is of, this is not my story, but I'll use it as a story of, you know, administering someone's pills and being told that the pills were tainted because your skin has touched the pills, and they don't want the potential of your Black skin in their body, right? And so that's a very specific type of racism that won't be addressed or talked about, because that's not necessarily how the racism might manifest if I was a Chinese nurse, for example. So I'm just saying, I don't think that the institutions are really in a position to address these things in the same way as us, because they also have lots of interest in protecting what they have.
I would go from that in saying that the institutions really need to start, you know, casting the gaze inwards and looking at what are they doing and who's doing it. I think first they need to start looking at who's doing the work, meaning who are the leadership folks here at the ministry, health authority level. Are those folks representative of the population that we serve or the workforce that we're in? One of the things that, you know, a lot of the nurses we've talked to so far have said is lack of representation. You know, sometimes they could have questions or issues coming along, and, you know, maybe they go to one particular avenue for assistance, but that is really geared toward, I don't know, Indigenous folks, for example. So that might not be the right mechanism for them to go through. So where do they go? But if a patient can't have an avenue, if a patient sustained harm in the health system, for example, and I've been in those sort of situations, and you're like, who do I speak to about this? How much more for us working inwards when we have issues, there's just nobody to speak to. There's nobody, or even speaking to is one step, but even people stepping in. You know, I practiced most of my nursing career in the States, and I can recall many situations where other folks came, basically fought my battles for me, right? If a patient was being, you know, this one particular one I remember was just yelling at me, going off, and charge nurse walks by, it was like, oh my goodness, Jifa, step out. I got this. Doors closed. I don't know what happened. When I went back in there later to give my medicines and stuff, there wasn't a lot of talking, but there wasn't a lot of yelling either. And that is perfectly fine with me. But I think the institutions, the health authorities, they need to start a diversifying their leadership. They need to be finding more, and this one is very practical. Like, we are in 2021, and the way we create patient assignments, for example, is the same way we did it, like, I don't know, since Nightingale's time. It's ridiculous. There are tools and there's ways that we can ensure that all nurses have adequate care or adequate level of workload. So there's really no culture of safety, whether it is, you know, patient safety or nurses' safety. There just isn't, it's just not there. So we're calling upon the institutions to create these culture of safety, particularly as far as racism is concerned, create the appropriate mechanism so that if I'm having issues, I know who to go talk to in confidence, and not to go talk to somebody that's going to tell me that I'm being sensitive or whatever, to go talk to somebody that's actually going to validate my experience and then do something about it.
I know that you mentioned earlier, like the murder of George Floyd earlier last year was a very specific intersection that really sparked kind of, you know, a lot of important conversations in multiple areas, including in health. So I'm wondering as well, are there other intersections that you think are really important and necessary to understanding how anti-Black racism specifically is manifesting and impacting the healthcare realm? I'm thinking specifically of things like COVID-19, obviously, might be a big factor, but are there also other things that you think would be important to speak to?
One of the things that's very interesting about the story of George Floyd is that he's an American man. And I think the thing about when we talk about anti-Black racism, there are lots of statistics that come from the States that can sort of back up this idea that it's a real thing. Oftentimes, racism in today's world is very difficult to sort of show because, like Zifa was saying, it's in the form of microaggressions, or it's sort of this feeling of uncomfort, you know, that you can't really specify. It's like in a look, or, you know, and I think in Canada, we haven't really collected race-based data, and we haven't, particularly around things like what you mentioned with COVID. And I think that's something that, for example, with our coalition, we're trying to do is, where are the Black nurses? What are their needs? Because then we're able to better address what's going on. I know that there has been reluctance in the past from several institutions, but, you know, we're making some progress. I know Kai High's sort of pushed for collecting race-based data. I think that's something that's like super important to have, because people understand numbers. They may not necessarily understand experience because they may not necessarily be Black, but they'll understand like, okay, this many deaths happened or XYZ.
And I would say that to add to what Nat has said, anti-Black racism, we have centuries of data, really, not from Canada, but across the world, to show how negative it impacts health overall. The literature shows that the longer you've lived in racist society from a Black person's perspective, the harder it is for that person to overcome racist encounters. So let's say that, you know, you were born in BC and, you know, every day that you go out, something happens that impacts you in a very negative way. If you're experiencing that every single day, you're not able to actually overcome the effects of that. And that becomes embodied in your body. It becomes physiology. They've done studies where if you were to take a Black person and ask them to declare their race, there are cardiovascular physiological responses that mimic stress for just checking a box that I'm Black, right? So people's blood pressure goes up, their heart rate goes up. So imagine that, just the act of checking the box Black, and multiply that by 2 years, 3 years, 4 years, 20 years of being in a system where everything you do is viewed through the lenses of your melanin, the content of your melanin. Imagine that. And so when we look at health disparities and people want to it's all because, you know, we need to raise Black people's education, we need to do this, we need to do that. I'm not saying those things are not important. The root of the problem is the discrimination that these folks are experiencing. So until we address the root, which is that, even when I get a job, people think you were just giving it to me because I'm Black, right? It must be because you are, we're being diverse. So we're going to hire a diverse person. So that still does not address the stress and all the other things that I have to endure in that environment. So, you know, I think anti-Black racism in North America is what is killing a lot of Black people here in North America, in Canada, even in South America, actually, to be honest.
In the previous question, we were talking about the importance of diversifying leadership. It's not a matter of just, you know, filling in a quota. A lot of people will think, you just try to sort of pander by hiring people. But the thing is, Canada in general, as opposed to the States, I think we kind of hide behind this like veneer of multiculturalism, where we think that everyone is accepted. In Canada, for the most part, from my experience, we haven't owned our own history when it comes to slavery, because I think it's important. We shouldn't be sort of using the narrative of our neighbor down south and why it's not just a matter of affirmative action.
Thanks, Nat, for bringing that up. So yes, slavery was an institution in Canada. Black people have been on this land as settlers for hundreds of years, much longer than the narrative that Canada pushes. The narrative that Canada pushes is that all Black people are relatively new. We're a product of immigration from outside lands, that we are not part of the national fabric of Canadian identity. So our presence is constantly erased and placed outside, and it's also always deemed urban. So this isn't like a new thing, but a very classic example that I'm sure will resonate with a lot of people is being asked, where are you from? As I've already mentioned, I'm biracial. So if I say my family immigrated from England and Scotland and came to Canada in the 1850s, that's not the correct answer, because I've tried it. The correct answer is that, you know, my family came from the Caribbean in the 1960s, and then suddenly all questions end. So just to bring it back into the nursing context, when my Blackness is always deemed outside of Canada and I'm trying to establish a relationship with someone, that's the first thing that's happening to me in my relationship. And that is an act of anti-Black violence. And that's almost always how my interaction starts. So when I'm told I have an quote unquote attitude problem, well, am I having an attitude problem, or am I having an emotional reaction? As Zifa says, these things literally change your physiology. There's huge health impacts for me. So I'm risking my health every time I'm having an interaction where racism is directed at me, so I can help this person with whatever their health needs is. And so you really then get into some other things that we won't get into, but theories around disposable nurse, whose bodies are disposable, what is our value. And because Canada refuses and has refused historically to collect race-based data, and this is ongoing because we've asked certain institutions, as we've collected, to collect that information so that we can serve, so we can know who the Black nurses are in BC, because I work by myself in my practice area. We know each other, but these are relatively new relationships. I've worked in huge emergency rooms. I've worked in rural areas. I've worked like in two different provinces, and I'm always the Black one. That speaks to how few of us and how really alone you can feel in your practice area. And because we don't collect that kind of information, the answer is we don't know. We don't know how anti-Black racism is being affected by ourselves. We know our own individual experiences. And it's to the point that a group of Black physicians from Ontario did a scoping review looking at breast cancers and cervical cancers in Black Canadian women. It's called Dying to Learn. And they call it that because the information isn't out there. They don't know. In the United States and the UK, it shows that Black women are much more likely to die of cervical cancer. And cervical cancer is one of the most preventable forms of cancers. But we don't know that for Canadian women. That's just like a huge unknown. And the information isn't there because we're trying to erase this Black presence. So if there's no Black people, then there's no reason why we'd need to collect race-based data in the first place. But the reality is that we're here. And we're hurting to not, in all these different ways, by not knowing.
I think that the one thing that to me is shocking of having, I actually grew up here, left, came back, and the shocking part of coming back was realizing, you know, often when we talk about white supremacists, people don't see themselves in it. People want to other folks, you know, people they might see on TV that are being overtly racist. Everyday people do not see how they have also bought into the idea of white supremacists. And to the point where I think some quote unquote minorities in Canada have also bought into that idea, right? Because you can't have white supremacists or supremacy without Blackness. Because Blackness exists to elevate the white supremacists. And so for other folks who are not neither Black nor necessary in the white supremacy, they can look at themselves and say, look, I am not doing too bad because at least I'm not at the bottom of the lot. At least I'm not Black. So I think one part of the Canadian racism is just that. People are complicit in their own ways and they always want to point it a finger at somebody else. Canada can't go on to the UN talking about human rights and all of that sort of stuff when people right here, not just Black people, Indigenous people, Asian people, whoever, vulnerable, marginalized people can get access to water, you know, can have a safe access to healthcare. You know, you can't be talking about, you know, being a leader in human rights without doing the hard work at home. So, you know, we're really hoping that, you know, the government institutions will take it up in terms of measuring where, how racism is impacting our society. You know, the coalition is also trying to awaken everybody else around to how white supremacy continues to stand as an ideology because we are complicit in it.
Yeah, everything that you've been sharing has really just underscored how necessary the coalition is. What has creating and joining the coalition brought into your experiences now moving forward as, you know, people who are still continuing to experience, you know, this anti-Black racism and other challenges of the healthcare system?
I was really, really struggling before this coalition because I, you know, was pretty much the only Black nurse I knew, whether it was like at my school or at work. And I felt nuts. Like I knew I just was in these environments that felt super unsafe, where I was kind of told to be in my place and sort of, for lack of better terms, cater to white fragility to stay in these spaces. And when the coalition came along, I realized it wasn't just me. It created an environment where there was solidarity, where I was seen and where I was valued. And I think that other people feel the same way. I know that the leadership team has been working hard to make sure that, you know, for those who are part of the coalition, that their voices are heard. And I think, as far as I know, we're the first forum where Black people that look like me, you know, are given the opportunities to feel like they matter. So for me, it's been an emotional, spiritual, psychological, you know, support, which is half the battle of this, right? Because racism, it's not an abstract or theoretical thing. There's a ton of emotional labor that comes with it. As nurses, particularly me as a mental health nurse, there's emotional labor from dealing with sick people. Carrying that with you on top of being a person of color is a lot. So I think this coalition has just brought me a lot more, I would say, I feel a lot more supported.
Yeah, I'm going to just echo what Nat said. Before this coalition, I was the only Black nurse I knew. After this coalition, not just the leadership team, but there's sort of this larger group that the leadership team kind of came from, sort of these organic conversations that were happening, and just hearing other people's stories validated these things inside myself that I knew to be true, but were never validated in any sort of formalized way throughout my nursing school and training or my professional career. It's now been 5 years as a nurse. That has been just by itself super empowering, because now I know that maybe someone at work won't get it, but I can turn to this group and say, this thing has happened. It's not enough, certainly. I want the things not to happen, but here's a very small example. One time when I was at work, I was on a coffee break and I was at the corner and someone ran his hands through my hair. My hair was braided at the time. He ran my hands through my hair and he told me, oh, it feels like a carpet. And I shared that experience with people I knew. And one of my friends, who's no longer a friend, said, well, did this person have mental illness? As if people with mental illness don't know whether or not it's appropriate to run their hands through people's hair. And the other thing is, there was lots of people on that corner, and the only person whose hands he ran through their hair was mine. So this gentleman knew, mentally ill or not, that it was okay to touch my hair, but it wasn't okay to touch someone else's. And it didn't even occur to me to say anything to my employer. It didn't even occur to me to say anything when I went back to the office. I just carried that by myself. And I think now when those kinds of situations happen, I know that that's something I should be saying. And I know that I can turn to other people and say, hey, these things happened to me at work. I don't know. I'm saying that one because it's a dramatic one, but there's all these things that happen that I cannot even verbalize or articulate, because you can just tell, you know, if you're a woman, if you have a disability, if you have anything that others you in any particular way, you can tell when someone is judging you or treating you in a bad sort of way. And so I can tell when something like that happens, but I can't always verbalize or explain what exactly has happened. So this group has at least brought me a place where I don't have to explain it. I can just say what's happened, and that can be enough.
I just want to say one more thing. I think that's what makes racism very difficult to address within our healthcare system, is the fact that it's sort of in these sort of, they could be written off as harmless events, right? It's, oh, he was just curious because your hair is different. And that, and so you always have to live your life in a way where you have to justify why it's racist. You have to come up with a million reasons why this is racism and not, you know, harmless ignorance.
I echo everything that both my sisters in this revolution, for lack of a better word, have said. I will say that, so I've been in a nurse for 20 years, and there's been a lot of times where I was the only Black person. And I think, there's a difference that I also recognize about being born Black here versus being an immigrant Black here. You know, honestly, I think earlier on in my nursing career, these things were a real struggle. But I think as time went on, I found my group of people. So when I say my group of people, not necessarily like Black people, but a group of mischiefs, for a better, like a better word, people who just didn't fit right? So in the ICU that I worked, it was the Filipino nurses. They didn't fit either. So I became one of the Filipino group. That's the group that I can go to and say, hey, did you see that assignment that we got? Why, you know, they're like, don't worry about it, we got you. Or how come is it that all the my shifts that I have put in has been switched around? Now, everything that I have planned has to be turned around. They're like, same thing happened to me. How about we try and figure a way to swap shifts so that they can take care of their kids and I can do all my academic stuff that I have to do. But it was like, you know, finding over time, I literally just found people that we didn't necessarily connect on the sense of skin color, but we connect on the way these white supremacist ideologies and policies impacted our daily living. And so I think the coalition, when I came here, if you had told me 4 years ago that I would be doing this, I would have laughed at you hysterically and walked away. Like, I did not think that I would be doing this. But when I came back, experiencing the shock and seeing that things have not actually changed from 20 years ago. So I think the coalition has really pushed me, because you can't not hear all of the stories that you've heard today and hearing others and looking at my own and not want to do something or take a stand. So maybe taking a stand is a better word. It has pushed me to take a stand.
Going back to the initial questions that were posed about the institutions that we hold accountable for maintaining systemic racism, it's not just hospitals, it's our government, and it's the schools that we go and actually learn about these things. I consider schools incredibly oppressive. There's a lot of talk about decolonizing academia, but I can say from my lived experience, the people that attend these institutions are the ones that end up going into the hospitals and the ones that go into the government, right? And so I think there's something to say about holding schools accountable for the education they provide, for the culture of safety that they also create for students. Just from a student perspective, how important the nursing academe is in all of this.
Given how important it has been for all of you to be able to find each other and connect, how can other people, other Black nurses also connect now with the coalition? And also maybe you can explain like how you initially connected as well. I realized we forgot to get to that, but.
So you can find us on the internet. Our email address is www.cacbn.ca. And there's a contact us form. So that's the best way to reach us. And then in terms of how we actually connected, we referenced her before, but huge shout out to a fellow UBC student, Isamalia, who went. So first of all, she created the first time the School of Nursing at UBC celebrated Black History Month was because of her last year. I think she reached out to the association for nurses, and they disseminated a link to all nurses across the province and said, if you identify as being Black, please attend this event. And so we all attended, and then we decided that we were actually unable to really do the work that we wanted to do in association with an institution that obviously, you know, is governed and controlled by white people, and that we really needed to take it on ourselves. And so then that's sort of how it was formed. And it's also important to note that she's actually from Europe. She's from Portugal and trained in England and then came to BC. And so it really was from, again, this external view saying, oh my God, what is going on with this racism, anti-Black racism in this province, in Vancouver?
And one thing I will add is that this coalition is, you know, we accept members or allies as well. I think it's important that in this work that we work with other people. So if other people are curious about us, like send us an email. We'd love to hear from you. And yeah.
And I would just add that I know we've probably had this discussion behind closed doors around the word allyship. I personally do not like the word allyship, because to me, it's a very shifty type relationship that maybe today you're with us, tomorrow you're not. And so what I would say is that if you believe systemic racism exists and that it is impacting all of us in negative ways, then you are so much welcome to join, to contact us, to join us. This is a fight for our lives, all of our lives. So you're standing in solidarity with the an anti-racist movement in reaching people. You know, we are doing some works around reaching out to schools, you know, nursing schools, reaching out to health authorities, reaching out through the union, reaching out through whatever mechanism, even through the quote unquote Black community. Like, and I would also give a shout out to our colleagues in medicine who are also championing the same thing, the Black physicians of BC. So if you're out there listening, say, well, I'm not a nurse, does that, no, there's a group there for you to go and join, and hopefully over time, maybe we'll just become the coalition and the coalition against systemic racism and making society a bit equitable for all of us to live in. So thank you.
Thank you so much for everything that you've brought today. And is there anything else that we've missed today or that you think is really important to add as well to this conversation before we head off?
I think Zifa's already said it, but I'll just say it again because I think it's so worth repeating. And that's just, you know, our goal isn't to replace whiteness with Blackness. Our goal is to interrogate and question a system that is harming us all. We all know, for example, living in Canada as Black people, that we are settlers and that there's been a long history of anti-Indigenous violence on this land. Our goal isn't to ignore that or to diminish that. The goal is truly just to talk about our experiences of racism so that the system can no longer divide us and isolate us and erase us. Because if we work together in a collaboration, we're going to have that, you know, maybe more equitable society. And we don't know, I don't know what that looks like, but I know that I can't do it alone.
We don't need to tell you that Vancouver has a housing problem.
Mass evictions.
Mass rent evictions.
Unfair rent increases.
What happened to rent control and protection from unfair eviction?
If these or other housing matters concern you, you may be interested in joining the Vancouver Tenants Union. For more information, visit tenantsunion.ca.
Welcome back to On the Point by CITR 101.9 FM, your source of alternative and undercover news from Vancouver and the Lower Mainland. You just heard Caitlin's long interview with Natanya, Kira, and Zifa from the Coalition of African, Caribbean, and Black Nurses in British Columbia.
Given the importance of data and the current lack of race-based information, as a follow-up, the CACBN is currently doing a survey to collect more data. So anyone who's interested in filling it out or just getting more information about the coalition can check out their website, www.cacbn.ca.
So before we end, let's touch upon a couple quick things. So first, let's talk about the $1 million donation from Peter Wall to the Vancouver Police Foundation. It was first reported by Mike Hager in the Globe and Mail, and apparently it's gone through sort of increased policing in the area. Specifically, he wanted to target, I think, the downtown east side. That was sort of the neighborhood he was the most concerned with, and so he basically made $1 million donation to the Vancouver Police Foundation for volunteer-led community police outposts across the city. So former News Collective host Joshua Zizi spoke with Professor Kevin Walby last year, and he's quoted in the Globe article talking about how basically undemocratic the police foundations are. We can get into that a little bit more in our discussion, but just basically I wanted to hear your guys' thoughts to start.
I think Jean Swanson was also quoted in the Globe and Mail article. She says it best. It's like, it's crazy that someone can have this much outsized influence on the police department who are supposed to be, you know, supposed to serve us allegedly and like, you know, be civically minded and all of that. But this sort of, it's not even back channel because it's so blatant, but this sort of out in the open sort of just influence being exerted like this, it's just wild. And yeah, I spoke to Harsha Walia about the fund earlier, not earlier this year, it would have been late last year. she said that the temptation to so there's been a lot of argument about the Vancouver Police Board and how just it's sort of enthralled to the police department. And she said the temptation to sort of increase the oversight of the police board ignores the fact that the Vancouver Police Foundation exists, which is an easy way for people to get their influence through. And it's like, it's supposedly a charity, right? So like, there's all sorts of like things where it's tax-free, your donations and stuff. So like, it's a whole thing. Like, this is one sort of part of the root of the problem with defunding the police and, you know, the resources that the cops get in the city and, you know, just everywhere.
Yeah, it's just quite staggering, really. Like, the amount of money that is so easily now just being funneled into the police through, like, their charity arm. And apparently, you know, like, this is quite a popular, I guess, tactic, you could say. Like, making a donation through these charity foundations, which are pretty much exclusively set up to, like, fund policing operations. I know that it was done, like, this donation was done specifically under the idea that it would go towards, like, supporting overdose crisis responses and, like, homelessness as well as something that, I guess, the VPD is supposed to be sort of the primary responders to. But, you know, really, like, the people who are actually responding to those situations more effectively are community groups and community organizations and sort of people with that lived experience on the front lines. So again, I don't understand why those people aren't receiving more of these exorbitant amounts of money when really they're the ones doing the work.
Yeah, agreed. And I also think that it's just, I mean, if we could talk forever sort of about the irony of the fact that a lot of people who live in poverty, and especially people who are who use substances, who live in poverty and who are homeless, are sort of aggressively and consistently criminalized. And it sort of all fuels into this self-perpetuating cycle that's really, really hard to step out of. So giving more money to the people doing the criminalizing effectively is just sort of like adding to this problem. So I feel like a lot of organizations now, or a lot of, you know, wealthy people who want to make $1 million donations to the police foundation, for example, use a lot of excuses like help assisting in the overdose crisis and trying to vet homelessness. And it's all just sort of, I mean, obviously my opinion, window dressing for what it actually is, which is influence within the police department. And I think that, I don't know, there was an article by the TAI that was done earlier, I think August, that talked about how, you know, tons of private firms like love to throw like millions of dollars into police foundations and police related charities just like across the country. And like big oil corporations specifically have been doing this for decades, but more and more recently. And it's like there's, I think Walby, the professor that we mentioned, is quoted thoroughly in this article as well, talking about how, you know, the Vancouver Police Department now has like a $500,000 SWAT mobile command center through the Vancouver Police Foundation's donations, essentially. And it's, yeah, these organizations are essentially set up as sort of like a reserves fund, if you will, for when things like the typical VPD budget gets cut. It's fairly transparent. And like, they do have great organizations, you know, that are things that they can sort of present to the public, I think, is like more acceptable. Like there's great groups that support women, and there are like at-risk youth services that are doing pretty cool work, but that's like a fairly small sliver of what this like greater police foundation budget usually goes towards. So I don't know. That's my long take on this, but
yeah, no, but I think it really also, again, underscores like the fact, like when the city was talking about reducing the VPD budget like last year, and there was a lot of uproar around that, and the VPD was definitely not on board. Like, let's say that it had gone through and like the budget was decreased by the city, you know, like then something like this happens where they still get like millions of dollars in funding through like these donations to their charitable foundations. So it's almost like, would it have even made a difference? Like, they're gonna be you know, getting support either way.
Absolutely. It's, yeah, it, the as I said, like, just earlier, like, they start cutting, like, let's say if the Vancouver Police Foundation is abolished tomorrow, they will still find a way to keep this sort of slush fund going. That is, the multiple ways in which the cops get so many, you know, blowbacks, taxes, and all of that. So, yeah, it's, I think this is just the latest example of how sort of easy it is to influence people's lives in this city and, you know, just beyond. It's fantastic. And talking about controlling people's lives through unjust systems, let's talk about rent evictions. So rent evictions, just to explain a little bit, rent evictions are when a landlord in, you know, the province can evict you because if they want to renovate that place, that is a valid reason they can give to evict you legally. So, but obviously the problem is that, you know, those renovations might be, they painted over like a crack in the wall or something. Like, there is no sort of legal definition of what a renovation is. And obviously this is done to attract new renters who are obviously desperate for a place to live and who can, you know, pay more. Whereas it's way harder to increase rent on existing tenants. So that's where rent evictions are done. So, sounds really bad, obviously, but our province apparently wants to come to the rescue. So, in the last week, they introduced new rules in the legislature about preventing rent evictions. That's what it says on the BC government website. So, the way they're doing it, allegedly, is they're adding another layer of bureaucracy. So, if landlords want to rent evict now, you know, I think this legislation is going to pass because the NDP has a majority. The landlords have to apply to the residential tenancy branch before renovating. Now, the problem with this is Sarah Sagai, who's spoken to us before on the show, she's a member of the Vancouver Tenants Union. She points out that Ontario has this almost exactly the same system, and that doesn't really prevent rent evictions because it's like these sorts of processes are very easy for landlords to do if they, you know, have the wherewithal. It might like weed out the odd spurious one, like someone replaces a tile and causes renovation. Like, they might weed out that, but it doesn't solve the overall problem. And plus, I think the sort of smoking gun amongst all of this is Landlord BC and other landlord groups. They're actually like in favor of this. Like, they've all said, oh, this is like good legislation, it's gonna help us, whatever. And I think that is like all the evidence you need to say that this won't help renters too much. As I said, like, it might help a few people, but not too many. So, you know, there's so many other things. The province also said that they're going to tie rent increases to inflation, which I guess is okay. I mean, it was previously at a set rate, but now it's tied to inflation, which I guess. But, like, I don't know. It's just weird to me that this is I think that should be like legislated at all. But anyway, and you know, there's others like things that they should have done really if they were thinking about stopping rent evictions, such as like the fact that the rent is tied to you, the tenant, and not the actual property doesn't make any sense, because if allegedly the price of the rent is going to go so up because you changed a tile in your house or whatever, why is that going to be imposed on a new tenant instead of anyone who wants to rent the place? You know, it doesn't make any sense. Like, you should be able to just come back to your old place, whatever. So just one final question before we end off, which is, do you think the current government will ever actually change the rules to make it better for renters? Like, just an open question.
Yeah, I mean, I think that, like, I don't know, I think that I'm going to avoid taking a stance on a hard like yes or no on this one, and just say that I think that, like, basically the Vancouver Tenants Union has fought very hard and won very significant victories over the last couple of years. And I think that, like, generally speaking, the government often does respond when there is enough pressure to respond in the appropriate way. So I think that there is a huge financial incentive, obviously, to not necessarily, like, side on the side of renters in BC most of the time. But I think that to say that, I don't know, to think that there aren't victories being made would also be underselling, I think, a lot of progress that's been, that has already happened in our rental market, and a lot of like people who haven't been evicted because of work done by organizers. So I don't know. I think that it's just a matter of continuing to push for things like tenant rights and continuing to try to combat things like overspeculation in the real estate market. But I don't know. I think also something worth mentioning for this, just if anybody is listening, with rent evictions, if you get an eviction notice, essentially the very, very first thing that you should do, whether it's a straight dem eviction or a rent eviction or whatever, is go to the RTB and file yourself, because you usually only have a very short window of time, usually less than 10 days at the absolute most, to actually file in and dispute your eviction. So just because you've been handed an eviction notice from your landlord does not mean that you have to leave, and doesn't mean that you don't have to fight it. And I think that's something also that with rent evictions, that's why we see a lot of people actually leaving and getting kicked out, because they don't realize that they don't have to go anywhere. So yeah, I think that there's a lot that can still be done. And I think that there are a lot of buffers in place that people can use to not have to give up their homes. So yeah, anyways, that's just my shout out to the RTB. But
yeah, and the Vancouver Tenants Union has great resources on their website. You can check out also about the stuff. Yeah, a lot of people don't know that. But yeah, so I don't know. I mean, I just laid out the various things that the government should be doing. But really, I mean, it just stinks that, you know, the idea that renovation can be used to just evict you for it just makes no sense to me. I don't know. Like, I don't know. It's just when you view housing as a commodity, it's just sick to me. Like, you know, but whatever. We're not going to get into large philosophical discussions. But you know, that's what the province is doing. It's a little, but it's not enough, as has always been the case.
I think Maddie brought up a really good point, which is that like maybe one of the things that the province should be doing is making this kind of information, at least about like existing options for renters, like they should be making that information more accessible, because that is such a good point that a lot of people don't know their rights and they don't know, you know, what their options are if they're faced with like a rent eviction or something. So in terms of whether or not the province is actually going to change the rules or anything, or what they should be doing, like this is something that maybe they should be doing, like giving clearer information and making it more of a straightforward process, because it's complicated enough as it is.
Yeah, absolutely. And I don't know, maybe they will. It's tough to communicate these sorts of things during a pandemic when you're not exactly traveling in buses, you're not exactly looking at, you know, ads and stuff, but maybe, hopefully. And obviously, organizations like the Vancouver Tenants Union will fight for those things, but, you know, you'll have to see. But yeah, on that lovely, stirring note, I guess we'll end this show here. So yeah, that's our show for this week. And you just listened to, you know, On The Point, CITR's new show. We'll be back next Saturday at 7 p.m. for more local news. And stay tuned for more amazing CITR programming.